coming up right now, Marianne Barry Sonek with the progressive Page Turner. Stay tuned for good books and their authors.
SLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at wslr.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barasonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. Easy access to unprecedented amounts of data and open communication has amplified flaws in the way humans process information. Instead of coming together around facts, we've been skillfully manipulated. We're now on the brink of an authoritarian dictatorship in the United States thanks to that manipulation. As a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and a senior advisor for public trust in science at the Aspen Institute, Lee McIntyre has studied science denial and the history of disinformation. Just before the 2024 election, he warned us about the war on truth in his book On Disinformation, How to Fight for the Truth and Protect Democracy. Lee, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with getting some terms straight. What's the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
That's really the whole ballgame. Misinformation is a mistake. It's when somebody believes something that's false, but it was an accident. Disinformation is intentional. Disinformation is when somebody intends to share false information and they do it for a particular purpose, which is to not only get their audience to believe it, but to get them polarized around a factual issue.
You write that the attack on science began 70 years ago. What happened?
70 years ago. So that would be, I can trace it even better than that. It was December 15th, 1953, at the Plaza Hotel in New York City. The heads of all of the big American tobacco companies came together to meet because they were scared to death of this forthcoming study, which was going to show that there was a link between smoking and lung cancer, and it was going to decimate their business. They wanted to figure out how to fight it. They brought in a public relations specialist who told them that they needed to fight the science. And they didn't mean fight it with evidence. They meant fight it with public relations, which they did with full-page newspaper ads and starting a precursor to the American Tobacco Institute, just really a kind of a propaganda campaign centered around the idea of creating doubt where there really wasn't any. This story is very well told in Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway's brilliant book, Merchants of Doubt. And they also pick up there on the idea that this was the beginning of modern science denial, because that was a blueprint. It's called the Tobacco Strategy. That was the blueprint that was followed by later deniers. That was the one that was followed by the climate deniers and others in subsequent years.
You studied science denial and how to talk to people like anti-vaxxers. But I wonder how much of this isn't just the industry casting doubt. People have experienced abuse by the medical profession, like the Tuskegee experiments, where men were allowed to die from syphilis and left untreated. And there's a lot of controversy about how pharmaceuticals are tested and marketed. You have drugs like Vioxx, which was unnecessary and dangerous, but it was going to make money, so it was approved. So how do we know who to trust?
It's a great question. The tricky thing about trust is that once it's gone, it's almost impossible to get it back. And so it's very important that scientists work in an environment of trust where they respect the position that they have and that people have when they're consuming scientific data. They certainly shouldn't be exploiting them or lying to them. The Tuskegee example, now, that's about as bad as it gets, right? Because this was the immoral experiment where it was untreated syphilis just to see what would happen. Interesting thing, though, about something like that, when people experience that kind of an event, I would say that they're not being radicalized through disinformation. They're being radicalized and distrustful over something that actually happened. And when that's the case, I think that it means that the doubt could possibly be overcome with further evidence. That is, that trust could be built back. The insidious thing about disinformation is that disinformation is a kind of information warfare where, as I said, the goal is not just to get you to believe something false, but to polarize you, to almost create a new identity so that you won't trust the truth tellers later on. So when people say, well, how can you just call people who don't trust science, science deniers? I don't do that. Some people don't trust science for good reason, like the ones that you mentioned. But in those cases, trust has to be earned back if it possibly can. The cases with disinformation, those are cases where it's not that scientists have done anything wrong. It's that people are lying about science. It's that people are pretending, for instance, that there are microchips in the vaccines, or that 5G is dangerous, or that, you know, that climate change isn't real, something like that. Say an industry wants to earn more money, or say that a politician wants to gain more power. Those are the egregious cases of disinformation that we need to learn how to fight back against. But in any case, those folks too are victims of lies.
And an example of that is something like the denial of Joe Biden winning the 2020 election. It was blatantly false. They lost 60 court cases that proved that there was nothing to the allegations, but people hung on to that belief. A majority of Republicans believed it coming into the 2024 elections. Why do people believe things that are blatantly untrue and easily refuted?
Well, I discussed this in my book. I started with January 6th. It's one of the most blatant examples that we can imagine. I mean, it almost makes you think that beliefs aren't about facts, that beliefs aren't about truth, that beliefs are really about identity. And there's been some work on this, in fact. There's been some empirical work to show that one really important factor in the beliefs that people hold is the beliefs that other people in their community hold. So it's not always about facts. And by the way, that's why facts won't necessarily convince someone. That's why if somebody holds a belief like that, the appropriate response is not just to share facts with them and then think that's going to work. And then if they don't accept it, to walk away. I've often said that the issue is that people who are deniers about vaccines, about climate, about January 6th, it's not that they have an information deficit. They have a trust deficit. That's what disinformation does. Disinformation erodes trust. And so, again, how do you get that back? It's very difficult to do. But demagogues understand very well how to erode trust. It's this cult-like ability to get people not to trust the truth tellers on the other side. Putin has been attacking American science for the last 20 years. Yeah, and you see that Donald Trump has learned how to pick up on that playbook. He's using Russian disinformation tactics when he is speaking to the American public.
You think that he's taken a page from Putin's playbook, or is he also being manipulated by Putin?
Might be both. He may be beholden to Putin for whatever reason. But what's clear is that whatever the motivation is, if you put side by side pieces of video footage, you'll see that Putin and Trump use the same techniques. One's called the fire hose of falsehood, which is when they just lie after lie after lie. Some of the lies even contradict one another. Now, why would they do that? Why would Trump lie, for instance, about the size of his inauguration crowd or the path of a hurricane or something that's factual that you can see with your own two eyes? Why would he do that? He's doing it because he's really asserting power. He's doing it because he's saying, you should believe me because I'm the boss, not because I have the evidence, not because I'm telling you what's true, but because I'm the boss. That's why Putin does it. Putin uses the fire hose of falsehood to assert his dominance over the truth, to bend reality to his will, to say, you live in a society in which the truth doesn't matter so much as what I tell you is the truth. I think that that's the world that Trump wants us to live in.
Are you going to believe me or your lying eyes, right?
That is exactly it.
So there's a statistic in your book that apparently 65% of the anti-vax info came from just 12 people. Why did they have so much reach?
Well, this was a study that was done by the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And they found that in 2019, that 65% of the anti-vax postings on Twitter were due to 12 people. They call them the disinformation dozen. And why did they have so much reach? Because they weren't stopped. That's it. They simply were not stopped. They could have been deplatformed. They could have been content moderated. There are all sorts of ways that you could contend with something like that. But if you look at the business model, they didn't, I guess, rise to the level. Look, and we can't blame that on Elon Musk, by the way. I know that sounds shocking, but it was predated Elon Musk. I remember the night that Elon Musk took over Twitter. I looked at Twitter and I checked the profile of each of the disinformation dozen. Eight of them were still there.
It has to be more than just they were allowed to talk, because it's kind of like if you throw seeds out there, there has to be ground that they'll take root in. And yes, these people had a message that I guess people wanted to hear.
Yeah, that ground is already fertile, unfortunately. Human beings have built-in cognitive biases that we are suspicious. We believe the first thing that we hear. It's called the primacy effect. We tend to believe things that are repeated over and over. Repetition effect, it's got other names. There are built-in weaknesses in human reasoning that people who are demagogues, people who are propagandists, know how to exploit. And so they do. And, you know, it's interesting that sometimes what they do is they take the propagandists, they'll take a little kernel of truth, and then they'll build a false narrative around it. So it makes it sound sort of less outrageous, or, you know, well, have you heard this? Have you heard that? If you challenge them, then they'll go back to maybe the kernel that was true and say, no, look here. And then it makes it tends to lend credibility to the other stuff that they pack around it.
What is micro-targeting, and how has that figured into disinformation?
Micro-targeting is one of the scariest things. We think of the example that you just used about Twitter, the 65% of the disinformation. That's broadcasting, amplification. That's trying to find the largest possible audience you can. Get your message out there as broadly as you can and it will eventually hit some people who want to hear it. Narrowcasting is when you have the tools, usually the marketing tools, say in something like Facebook, where you can figure out who you want your audience to be. So you're tailoring your message specifically to the people that you want to hear it, which means that people outside that group may not hear it at all. Think about on Facebook the way that marketers sell backpacks and cosmetics and sneakers. They look, you know, well, we want people who are between 18 and 34 years old, this gender, this race, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll go through, and all those tools are already built in for marketers. Those tools can also be used to spread hate.
So they look for people who are ready to fall into the abyss, and they just give them the push to go down rabbit holes that they might not have done otherwise.
That's how terrorist organizations recruit on social media. They find the people that they think will be fertile ground for their message, and those are the ones that they narrowcast it to.
The Sarasota African American Cultural Coalition presents the photographic art of Sarasota native Michael Kinsey at the historic Leonard Reed House. Kinsey's black and white photographs spotlight the contributions of longtime African American residents and black retirees living along the Suncoast. These portraits were chosen to celebrate the strength, resilience, and multifaceted identity of Sarasota's Black community. This exhibit is on view through the end of July. Visiting hours are Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 2529 North Orange Avenue in Sarasota. More information is available at thesaacc.org. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Lee McIntyre, and we're talking about his book, On Disinformation. The algorithms on social media, I think we've all heard by now how they reinforce biases because they show people what they've looked for in the past. How much do we know about exactly how those algorithms work? And wouldn't that be the place to start putting in brakes?
Yes, that would be a perfect place to put in the brakes. But we know almost nothing about the algorithms. They're black boxes. They're known basically only to the senior engineers at the companies that own them. They're proprietary. I mean, we've seen from the outside that they are able to be changed. There was this golden moment in the fall of 2020, just before the 2020 election, when Facebook and Twitter, and I think YouTube, began to do more content moderation. They began, for a while, to maybe dial things away from engagement and toward truth, and you would see more content moderation. You would click on something to share, and it would say, are you sure you want to share this if you haven't read it? Or it would provide context. But after the election, they took that away and stopped doing it.
Do you think that influenced the election?
I don't know. I think it certainly had something to do with January 6th.
Moderating the content?
No, the fact that they took it away.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
the fact that they took it away. I have a friend, Stephen Lewandowski, who's a cognitive scientist at University of Bristol, and he's got a proposal that what we really need is transparency at the social media companies. We need them to allow a panel of experts, university experts, say, from outside the companies, to look in the black boxes and see what's there and assess it for community harm. You could do all you wanted to shield user data. You could do everything that seemed necessary to make sure that privacy was respected. But that would be one way to handle this. And it's funny, too, because here I am going to lay this at Elon Musk's feet, because for all his talk about being radically in favor of free speech and against censorship, why is he so private about the algorithm for X? Why doesn't he allow this sort of thing? I mean, why do we need to wait for a whistleblower to come forward to find out, you know, we've got something on our hands that might cause community harm?
How is this different than censorship?
Well, that's a great question. It is different than censorship in the following way. Refusing to amplify someone else's lie is not censorship. Deciding that you're not going to help them to get their lie out. Say you were a radical free speech proponent and the Ku Klux Klan had applied for a parade permit in your town. You might be uncomfortable with it, but you think, well, you know, a radical free speech, we have to let them parade. And you might even plan a counter parade or protest or whatever it is. But are you required to go down to their rally and help them hand out flyers? No, you're not. You're not required to help someone amplify their message. And that is exactly what the social media companies are doing. They're helping liars to amplify their message. So the social media companies could very easily decide that they didn't want to do that. I don't think that's censorship. The other factor here, which is that disinformation is censorship, because what's the goal of censorship? It's to keep people from hearing the truth. Well, censorship is when you erase the truth so nobody can hear it. But disinformation is when you obscure the truth so nobody can see or hear it. It's the same goal, isn't it? The idea is that you cover up truth with lies.
So I want to go back to the analogy that you had about the Ku Klux Klan parade. The social media companies would allow the posts to happen, but would they not allow people to share them? Or would they do things more like present, if someone shares a post that is pretty egregious, that then they would put something in their feed that would counter that?
They could, or they could tweak their algorithm. Right now, the way that the algorithms tend to work is that if you watch one flat earth video, it sends you to another, and then another, and then another. If they tweak the algorithm so that it could provide you counter information that was truthful information, that might be preferable. I think the most straightforward way is simply to have, I mean, the most arresting thing when I see it is when they have a little context box at the bottom. You click on something that looks questionable, egregious, outrageous, and then at the bottom it explains what this actually is. And then you understand. So it provides a kind of a truthful framework for what you're seeing. You do see that now and then on social media. They could do more of that. But I want you to remember, too, that social media companies are allowed by law in the United States to take down any post for any reason. They're protected by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. They cannot be sued for anything that they leave up or anything that they take down. So it's really up to them. So when you see something on there that's absolutely outrageous, you can ask the company, why did you let this through? You might say, well, they missed something. Well, okay, they don't miss porn. They don't miss beheadings. They don't miss terrorist attacks. Why not? Because they scrubbed for those. Because they know that their audience would be horrified if they saw those. And so they have a human team that scrubs before it even gets to you so that you don't see that. Could they do the same thing for false information about a vaccine or an election? Yes, they could. They've chosen not to.
Yeah, but I can see why that would be perceived as much more heavy-handed censorship than the idea of just also providing people with counter information. Getting back to your analogy with the Klan rally, is it would be somebody handing out leaflets saying how violent the Klan is and what they had done.
Yes, that's right. Counter information. Imagine a video about January 6th, propaganda video about January 6th. But it was framed in a box that said, these questions had been litigated before the courts and were ruled against Trump 60 times.
Yeah, but then doesn't that get back to the idea that no matter how much information you give people, they're going to believe things that are blatantly untrue?
You raise a good point. I mean, I suppose that's true, but you don't know when somebody, are they seeing that for the first time? Is this their naive subject? It would be nice if we did less amplification of falsehood. But, you know, another way to fight back is to amplify truth. Human beings believe things that are repeated. So why not repeat the truth over and over?
And if you could get people at that first engagement with one of these disinformation campaigns, before identity has been attached to the lie, then there might be a possibility of this working. Well, let's switch tracks here for a little bit. It isn't just social media that's the problem. How have journalists also been complicit in spreading disinformation?
There are some media outlets that simply lie. They've been adjudicated so in court to understand that they lie, and we all know who we're talking about there.
Right. We're talking about Fox News, who admitted in court that they weren't a news program. They were an entertainment program.
That's right. But then there are mainstream outlets. And here I want to be careful, because this is tough love, because if anybody's coming to save us, it's investigative journalists. It's the news outlets that are doing their job with good journalistic values. The problem is that if you look at how some mainstream media behave, one of the values that they have for themselves is not to be accused of political bias. And so sometimes they react to that by pretending to be even-handed on an issue in which there really aren't two sides. I mean, we used to see this where they'd have split-screen debates over the truth of climate change. You don't see that anymore. The BBC, I think, stopped doing that. There are other outlets in the United States that have stopped doing that. The lazy way to show objectivity is to find somebody on one side, find somebody on the other side, let them both talk, give them equal time, and then leave it up to the audience to decide. But that's not really good journalism, because then you're leaving your viewers or your listeners less well-informed than when they started. So there is a responsibility, I think, for journalists, which is to tell the truth, which is not to be afraid of the accusation that they are being biased when they're not, you know, understanding that part of the time that accusation is coming from people who are fighting an information war against them.
So what advice would you give somebody who has to interact on a daily basis with someone who is either a science denier or who believes some blatantly false things?
I get heartbreaking letters from people who have a family member who is a flat earther or an anti-vaxxer. And they want to know what to do. I wrote an earlier book called How to Talk to a Science Denier. And these folks really, it's heartbreaking. And I give them the same piece of advice, which is to remember that this is fundamentally about trust, and that you should not break off your relationship with that family member. You cannot persuade someone against their will. You can preserve the relationship and look for your moments so that when they're ready to hear from you, when they're ready to hear information that might challenge their point of view, that you can provide it. It's been shown that trying to persuade someone is not as effective as simply letting them talk, letting them ask questions, and then being there to provide answers if they're willing to listen.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Lee McIntyre, and we've been talking about his book on disinformation, how to fight for truth and protect democracy. Lee, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.